The following lecture is provided by Biblical Training. The speaker is Dr. Timothy Tennant. More information is available at www.biblicaltraining.org.
Let's move now to what is known as the Night of Power and Excellence, which is found in the Quran. Muhammad, according to tradition, is a very religious, spiritual-oriented person, in a very broad sense of the word. And according to their tradition, he frequently goes into the hills around Mecca for prayer and fasting and meditation. There was a month that during the caravan trades that they had agreed upon certain months where you would not raid. The ninth month was one of the agreed upon months where they had reached treaties that said on this month there would be no raiding allowed. Okay, this is like honor among thieves kind of thing. This is really important because, as you'll see later, Muhammad feels very, very betrayed by the Jews at a certain point in his career. And we'll look at this later, maybe today actually. But it's all based on treaties, that how he understands certain treaties. In the Arab world, a treaty means a lot. And these treaties would be agreed upon in certain, there have been tremendous studies on this, on how they agreed and the way their government was done, because they didn't actually have a dictatorship, but they didn't have democracy either. They had something in between. And it's been a very fascinating thing. They basically would get together as a clan, and the leader would say to the clan, "What do you think? What's your opinion on it? What should we do?" And it'd be almost in a remarkably democratic environment where people would say, "Well, we ought to do this or do that," and everyone had their voice. But at some point, the thing would be closed, and then the leader would decide, "We will do this." And once he said that, that's it. You know, they were now bound to do it that way. So it's this interesting combination of democracy and, essentially a, you know, a tribal chief autocracy type thing. So these treaties were very, very important. And the month of Ramadan, which, as you know to this day, or even if you don't know, you will know soon, Ramadan is a very important month for Muslims today. And it's because of what happened on this month. But it's important to recognize historically that Ramadan is already a sacred month for Arabs before Muhammad's even born. Ramadan was a month for prayer and fasting. Today, of course, we'll see later, this is the month of fasting for Muslims. But this is already a month of fasting. Muhammad is in the caves fasting during Ramadan when he received his first words of the Quran. Now, according to the Quran, we're told that the Quran was revealed to Muhammad. I'll read, for example, in Surah 2, Ayah 185. I'll quote these words for you. "In the month of Ramadan, the Quran was revealed, a book of guidance with proofs." By the way, in the Arabic, that's the word for ayah. This word we have for verses, you know, surahs and ayahs, with literally signs, signposts of guidance distinguishing right from wrong. "Therefore, whoever of you is present in that month, let him fast." So this is actually the origin of the fast in Islam, because the Quran was revealed during Ramadan. Now, there is some dispute about what surah in the Quran represents the first revelation of the Quran. It is generally called, as you see the heading here on the handout, the Night of Power and Excellence. That is supposedly the night in which Gabriel appears to Muhammad, and Gabriel gives Muhammad the first revelation of the Quran. The earliest Quran is, many believe, it occurs in Surah 96. If you'll turn there, I told you to make sure you bring your Qurans with you, because it's so important to look at these passages. This is believed by many Muslims. There's actually, like everything else, you might imagine, there's some disagreement among Muslim communities on this point. But I would say a vast majority believe that this passage, this first two ayahs here, is the earliest revelation of the Quran. "Recite in the name of your Lord who created man from clots of blood. Recite, your Lord is the most bountiful one." This is what the word Quran means. This is the resuscitation. This is to recite. And so there is a connection between the word Quran and the word recite. And so this is what is claimed to be a very, very early surah. Now, it is believed that this occurred on either the 23rd, 25th, or 27th night of Ramadan, toward the end of that month. It is believed that it occurs, and different sects of Islam will celebrate different times. The other very early one, this is very, very important, is found in Surah 74. It's Surah 74, Ayah 1. You that are wrapped up in your vestment, arise and give warning. This is also cited as some people believe, the earliest of the surahs, where he basically commands Muhammad, the you here refers to Muhammad, Muhammad is wrapped up in a vestment, arise and give warning. In other words, give warning to the pagan tribes of Arabia. This is like Muhammad's call to ministry or call to the apostleship is the kind of the way this is interpreted. So, Muhammad begins to receive revelations according to the Quran, again in Surah 76, Ayah 23. Again, some Muslims dispute this point, but you point out to them in the Quran and they'll eventually be happy. The Quran was not given at one night. It was not given like in one, click of the mouse download as attachment to Gabriel's, document. The Quran teaches it was done gradually. This is why we do have pre-Meccan, Medinan, and Meccan surahs. If you look at 76, it's actually Ayah 23, though your Quran may not show that closely. It is actually Ayah 23 of Surah 76. We have made known to you the Quran by gradual revelation. That is the text in the Quran, which shows what in fact is true, that the Quran came over a period of time. So from the time Muhammad first received his Quran in the year, received revelation 610 until the year 632, during that entire period, the Quran is revealed. And you'll notice on the back of this handout on the terms, there are several dates that are very important. You should know now 570 AD is birth, 610 the first revelation, 632 is the death of Muhammad, and he receives revelations all the way up to the time of his death. So the Quran is actually done over a period of 22 years that Muhammad receives the revelation of the Quran, and so that is important. It's a gradual revelation. Muhammad essentially begins to share his revelations. He is obviously is met with a lot of rejection because the Quran itself teaches in Surah 81, 19 to 25. A lot of this information I'm giving you is reproduced strictly out of the Quran. In Surah 81, 19 to 25, he specifically has Allah responding to his critics who claim he's a madman. So there's definite evidence that Muhammad was widely challenged. However, we're told that when he received this revelation, that he immediately crushed his father's idols, and he regularly began to retire into the hills for revelations. I'm not sure if you are aware of the Jewish revelation regarding, I say revelation, it's in the Midrash, but the tradition about Abraham when he received the knowledge of Yahweh. According to Jewish tradition, which is recounted in the Quran, you'll read about it if you haven't already, that when Abraham was a young man and he received the revelation of the one true God, he goes down, according to Jewish tradition, Abraham was an idol maker. And so Abraham goes down into the downstairs area, and he finds all these idols everywhere. He takes a club, and he destroys all of the idols except for one. And then he puts the club in the hand of the biggest idol. And then he goes to sleep. Well, his father is furious and wakes up and is asked to ask Abraham, why did you destroy all these idols? And he says, well, why do you think I did it? Well, who else would have done it? He said, well, look who's holding the club. You know, there's this idol there with this club. And of course, it was used to show that obviously even Abraham's father didn't believe these idols had power. They couldn't even destroy the other idols. So this is an old Jewish story that was told. Well, this is recounted in the Quran. And Muhammad's own life, they're very careful. Again, whether it be hagiography or remarkable coincidence, Muhammad's life parallels the same thing. He had a revelation of monotheism. His father was from the Quraysh tribe. They were the ones that protected the idols. They were involved in idol trade. Muhammad destroys the idols and begins to proclaim the one true God. In that sense, there is a probably deliberate, but if not, nevertheless remarkable, parallel between Abraham and Muhammad at that point. You may recall also in the book of Acts, in chapter 19, verse 25 and following, in Acts 19, 25 and following, you have the story of Demetrius, who is extremely upset at how the preaching of the gospel will affect the idol trade in Ephesus. And he gets together all the craftsmen and silversmith and basically says, hey, we have a good income from this business. We can't allow this doctrine that, you know, idols are no idols at all, no gods at all to exist. And therefore, they make a plot against the Apostle Paul. What you find is that even though Muhammad's from the Quraysh tribe, the Quraysh tribe oppose Muhammad vehemently because they get their living from the idol trade. They are the guardians of the Kaaba, which contains the 360 images. And therefore, there is tremendous opposition to Muhammad in these early days. And they claim that he wasn't being a true Arab. They claim he was spending too much time with foreigners. Again, a surely indication that he was spending time with Jewish or hermits, other groups. They claim that he was not a true Arab, which is remarkable because it seems like this is the same kind of thing that we encounter today in many circles. Oh, you're not being a good Arab or good Muslim if you hear the gospel preached, or Indians who say you're not a true Indian if you talk to Christians and all of this. So Muhammad did convert his wife and his uncle Abu Talib and others close to him, but essentially he had a good bit of opposition from the Arabs. So this is the time when Muhammad, like a good Arab, he has to make alliances. This is absolutely critical to understand how Arabs think. Muhammad realizes that he cannot sustain this without good allies. Now, he naturally has potential allies among the Hanafs, and many believe that the Hanafs readily came to his cause. So what little core he has are probably Hanafs who are adopting Islam. That won't be a problem. But there's not enough of them. That's a very small community. And so he realized he needs to do a better job. So if you look at this map of the world, you'll see that there is... here's Arabia, and Muhammad crosses over the Red Sea here, and Muhammad crosses over into what is today Eritrea and Ethiopia. Now, this is, as you know, Ethiopia is a very ancient Christian community, one of the oldest Christian communities in the world. And so by the 7th century, there is a strong Christian community in Ethiopia. Or at the time it was called Abyssinia, you know, Abyssinia, but it's the what today we call Eritrea and parts of Ethiopia. So he crosses over and he wants to form an alliance with the community there, of the Christians there. Now this shows that Muhammad still sees very much his revelation in continuity with Jewish and Christian revelation. He is seeing that the Jews have a book, the Christians have a book, a revelation. The Jews have a monotheistic vision. The Christians have a monotheistic vision, even though they're obviously confused about Christ. They're essentially, it's a monotheistic religion. And so he is trying to form alliances. Well, he knows that Christians have a very high view of Christ. And so if you actually look at your Quran and you look at the 19th surah, what is the title of the 19th surah? It's called Mary. Now, this, of course, is reference to Mary, mother of Jesus. He's aware that not only Mary, but also that Jesus and Mary are very, very important to Christians. And so it's in this surah that one finds probably one of the most positive resuscitations in the Quran about Jesus. Because it's at this point that Muhammad uses this particular text. Of course, according to tradition, it was actually not spoken by Muhammad, but it was spoken by Abu Talib, his uncle. But nevertheless, that Muhammad and his uncle made a plea to the Christian king of Abyssinia, whose name is Negus. This king, Negus, is, you often believe, is one of the first Christian kings in the world. So they were groups from Mecca who realized the potential problem of Muhammad forming an alliance outside of Arabia with Christian kings. So the Muslim, a group of Meccans went over to bribe King Negus to say, do not form an alliance with Muhammad and Abu Talib and this upstart group, form one with us. So there was a lot of pressure on because Negus, being a Christian, he would not accept a bribe, and therefore it was always based on the merits of the case. So in a sense, this is Muhammad's opportunity to put his best foot forward in terms of Christianity. So Muhammad's, this particular surah is Muhammad explaining essentially a pro-Christian rhetoric on the Quran. Now, it is true that there's things he says that definitely disturb us, but he will say in this surah that Jesus was born of a virgin, that Mary was a virgin. It's also interesting how Muhammad weaves in what he thinks are gospel accounts that we now know, from our point of view, these are pseudepigraphal accounts. So, for example, he has Jesus speaking from the crib. You know the passage in the pseudepigrapha where Jesus takes clay and he makes a bird of it and the bird flies away? Muhammad recounts these stories right along the line with everything else. And so, again, it helps you to see that Muhammad's knowledge of Christianity is extremely, you know, diverse. He is a lot of oral tradition here. Again, no textual guidance. So you have Jesus without sin. You have all kinds of things here that are quite amazing in these verses, though he also does cite the traditional Muslim line that Allah can have no partner or no son. Well, Negus is not going to be bribed, and eventually, Negus is essentially very positive toward the Muslims, and there's a potential alliance here, though he's not quite ready to completely accept that. He wants to check Muhammad out, some of his other contacts that he has on the peninsula. But certainly, this is a potential thing. But meanwhile, things are getting very, very tense in Arabia. Muhammad cannot wait any longer because he's about to be defeated militarily in Mecca. And so, finally, there is a huge breakthrough that happens up in the other twin city in Arabia, the city which is today called Medina, but in those days was called Yathrib. Yathrib is the northern of the two towns. So you have Yathrib and you have Mecca. Mecca is where the Kaaba is. This is Muhammad's base. This is where he's born. The revelations occur, but he can no longer stay in Mecca. The Quraysh tribe is too powerful. Well, meanwhile, the Yathrib is actually gone through tremendous problems in their own tribal structure. They're under a lot of pressure. Now, Muhammad is preaching a doctrine that says the one true God, Allah, will unite all the tribes of Arabia. We can be a great force in the world. Okay, so Muhammad has this vision for a united Arabia. Well, the one thing that Arabia was not was united. I mean, this was a very divided, sectarian kind of, you know, again, very sketchy truces and all the raiding going on and all that. So Yathrib has two things going for it. It has a large Jewish community, which are predisposed for monotheism, and therefore they're going to be happier with a monotheistic Arab, in other words, a growing, from their point of view, a growing Hanif movement, less polytheism. And then you have these divisive tribes that have really been worn down, and they essentially say, if we unite together, we can outdo Mecca in terms of trade, and we can work together, and maybe Muhammad can help us out. So there is a desire to essentially create an alliance between Muhammad and the tribes of Yathrib. And so they, during the same time when Muhammad's talking to the Christians, they agree to give him a safe passage and protect him in Yathrib. And this, of course, becomes the tremendous, what is to this day called the birth of the Muslim year, the birth of Muslim civilization, everything, is what they call the Hajira or the Hejira. This is a very, very important term. This refers to the flight or the exodus. Again, the parallels are here. You have this exodus out of Mecca to the promised land of Medina. The term, the city of Yathrib is renamed Medina, as it is to this day. The word Medina means city of the prophet. So this is the basically celebrating the fact that Muhammad's going to come and reunite and restore this the importance of Abraham. Again, the Jews were happy because here is an indigenous prophet from Arabia who is saying Abraham is so important. Abraham is the most important man in history. They like that. He's saying that there's only one God. They like that. He's saying that idols are corruption. Idols should be all destroyed. They love that. He accepts the Ten Commandments. Seven of the Ten Commandments appear in the Quran. And so, you know, at least there's a core, especially the first ones. There shall no other gods before me, no graven image. That's very important to Jews. Muhammad is saying, I agree with this. He's preaching this. He even calls the Jews the people of the book, al-Kitab. And this makes the Jews very, very happy. The Jews had suffered under the idolatrous pagans of Arabia. They had suffered under all the infighting. And Muhammad is arguing for a larger community. And I think the Jews as well had a very positive perception that this could be a good thing. And this all goes horribly sour later on. But at this point, I think it's considered a very, very positive thing. So Muhammad flees. This is in the year 622 A.D., by our reckoning. As you know, Muslims will not count their calendar, obviously, according to our reckoning, which is based on, you know, the year of our Lord. So the Muslims to this day will reckon their calendar according to, rather than A.D., A.H., after the Hejira. So this is the beginning of the Muslim calendar occurs when Muhammad flees Mecca, he flees to Medina, and he begins the new community there. In order to figure the Muslim year, by the way, the Muslim year is figured by, it's a lunar year, so it's very difficult. It's not just taking 2001 and subtracting 622. You have to do that first, which would come to, what, 1,079? Then you have to add to that one extra year per century, because you have to, I'm sorry, 3 years per century to make up for the fact that a lunar year is slightly shorter than a solar year. The lunar month is shorter than the solar month. And so it comes out to an additional 42 years are added over. So this would be 1,421 AH. That would be how Muslims determine their time. So they date their entire calendar and their entire movement back to not the revelation from the hills around Mecca, but from the Hejira. Why does the Hejira mark the beginning of the Islamic era? And I think I'll mention briefly three things. Prior to the Hejira, the Quranic revelation, of course, is still incomplete. The revelations to Muhammad are essentially disparate. There are a few straggling individuals and small little groups that believe it. It is not a movement. And so after the Hejra, this becomes almost overnight a movement from a collection of private insights, however profound, however disturbing, whatever, into a movement. So they often say that things go through three stages. A man, used generically, man or woman, a man, a movement, and a monument. This is said kind of as an observation that you have some catalyst figure, enter into a movement of some vibrancy, and eventually it solidifies into something that is merely a monument. And if that's true, this is the point where we move to the movement stage. There's a lot of things that happen that people begin to join Muhammad. There's a group, I don't believe that I have the name, I do not on the back of this, but there are groups of people that this Quran mentions that flee with Muhammad and support him. So his numbers begin to swell. These are people, they actually call them the Muhajirs. These are people that were put out of their homes because of their confession of monotheism. So there was a little bit of a plundering going on and people leaving their homes. Those who were waiting in Medina to receive him were known as the Ansar. And the Ansar are those that are in Medina. So when you collect the Ansars with the Muhajirs, and these are terms you do not need to know, but those are the classifications for those who flee with Muhammad, those who are waiting in Medina for Muhammad, and together these create a genuine movement that can no longer be ignored. And so that's why one reason why the Hejra is considered to be the catalyst moment. The second is the Hejra marks a period where Muhammad begins to at least the early seeds of, from what I call here, religious continuity to religious change up until the Hejra. Until, in other words, the pre-Medina surahs, the chapters in the Quran that are all before the Hejra, they are all stressing the continuity of the Islamic revelation with Judaism and with Christianity, especially with Judaism. And so there's this very nice continuity being emphasized in the writings. And we would not be fair to say that completely stops at the Hejra, but the tide begins to turn. At this point, Muhammad begins to recognize more and more that his movement might be distinct from Judaism. This is like with Christianity. At what point do the Christians recognize they're no longer a sect of Judaism, that we're now a separate movement? In a sense, this is a movement which could be like, well, these are just Hanafs. These are just Muslims that are accepting Jewish revelation, etc. But they're beginning to make changes. You have a number of changes that begin to occur in the Medina surahs. For example, you have, and I won't take time to read all of these, but in 12:28, you find distinct change in the Joseph story that are not according to the biblical revelation. You have a remarkable passage in Surah 9:30, which no one knows the historical basis for this, where Muhammad asserts that Jews believe that Ezra is the Son of God, the way Christians believe Jesus is the Son of God. Where in the world Muhammad heard this? There's, to my knowledge, no evidence of Jews believing this. So you begin to have Muhammad putting, words in the Jewish mouths, as it were, and changing stories. You have Abraham, for example. You have Abraham in Surah 2:127, Abraham and Ishmael building the Kaaba and asking Allah to send a prophet to proclaim the truth to the people of Arabia. So he begins to chastise the Jews more in the text. He says in Surah 6, Surah 6, 91, you have Muhammad declaring that the Jews had distorted or suppressed the original revelation. Now that's very, very important. Because for the first time, you begin to see the emergence of, rather than a continuity theme, which we find in the pre-Medina surahs, you have a theme which says that the Jews have corrupted the original pure. Now there's finally a movement building the Kaaba and asking Allah to send a prophet to proclaim the truth to the people of Arabia. So he begins to chastise of the Jewish Old Testament, what we call the Old Testament. So the Jews are going to say, no, that's not right. Well, at this point, it's already been incorporated into these revelations. So it's dictation theory. It cannot be abrogated. And so Muhammad is saying, wait a minute, if your story says that it's Isaac, and I'm telling you it's Ishmael, then I'm sorry, you're wrong. So you begin to see the Jews and the Muslims having conflict now, because he is openly contradicting Jewish textual traditions in the Old Testament. So this is important. It's one thing to say Abraham is the father of faith and the father of monotheism, and we agree with that. But he begins to say that the pure monotheism has been distorted and corrupted by Jews and by Christians. So that's another reason why the Hijra marks the beginning of an Islamic era. Thirdly and finally, the exodus of the Hijra marks the new authority, which is a basis for a unified Arab empire. Now you begin to find, prior to this point, the Arabs were essentially a very fractious group, a lot of infighting, a lot of rivalry. They were not united. These were Bedouin tribes that were more or less opposed to one another, especially eastern and western parts of Arabia. Now you begin to see links being made, or at least the possibility that the Quran can unite the Arab peoples, which eventually, of course, happens. After the death of Muhammad, there's 100 years of literally the explosion of the Arab armies, and they create a whole Arab civilization that dominates the eastern world, and even all the way to the western world into Spain itself. So this is the beginning of that, where there's now the possibility of trans-tribal union, or a pan-Arab unity. And to this day, Muslims kind of play on this term, that Islam is a pan-Arab movement that will unite all Arabs all over the world into this seamless garment that they call the Ummah, is the term for this. The term Ummah means community. It's a very important term in Islamic theology. The idea that all Muslims everywhere form this seamless garment of a single community. It's a total myth, actually, but they talk in these terms as if it's a non-divided group. And certainly in these early days, Islam will produce a unity among Arabs that is unheard of in up to that point in history. By the way, one of you pointed out to me that in the Quran, a passage which does include the exodus from with Pharaoh, so I make that correction. The initial part of the Exodus is mentioned in the Quran, and the theology of the Exodus is indeed omitted by Muhammad. He doesn't really mention entering the Promised Land and all of that, but he does mention the being driven out by Pharaoh. So that's a correction I need to make in the notes I made earlier. Okay, once Muhammad arrives in Medina, this is where the movement really begins to consolidate, and he becomes a major power broker in this new city of Yathrib. The Jews are, you know, very much a part of this, because he now is, for the first time, has a lot of more serious and formal contact with Jews. And in the passage, you have Old Testament stories which are being, you know, cited inaccurately, and there are problems with this. You'll notice in Surah 2, Ayah 129, you have, for example, where you have, this is that, by the way, that statement I mentioned earlier, actually go back to Surah 2, Ayah 127, which says, Abraham and Ishmael built the house. The house refers to the Kaaba. Abraham and Ishmael built the Kaaba and dedicated it, saying, accept this from us, Lord. You hear all and you know all. Now, here's Abraham, here's Muhammad saying that Abraham came down to southern Arabia and with his son Ishmael built the Kaaba. That's not in the Old Testament, obviously. The Jews say that didn't happen. Okay, there's this big conflict there. Muhammad insists that it does happen. So you begin to have these problems. He has Abraham praying, Lord, that would be Yahweh, send forth to them an apostle of their own, We had our apostles, our messengers, our prophets. The Christians have theirs. The Jews, the Muslims need their own prophets. So the Arabs need their own prophets. Who will declare to them your revelation, instruct them in the scriptures, that's interpreted to be the Quran, and in wisdom, that is interpreted to be the hadith. We have yet to look at that yet. Another whole group of writings. And purify them of sin. You are the mighty, the wise man, wise one. Who but a foolish man would renounce the faith of Abraham? And so, again, goes into this whole thing about Abraham. But if you read the passage, you can see that Muhammad tells them, listen, I'm accepting Abraham, but you have distorted it. You have changed it. It says in 135, accept the Jewish or the Christian faith, and you shall be rightly guided. Say, this is Allah telling Muhammad, say by no means. We believe in the faith of Abraham, the upright one. He was no idolater. We believe in Allah, that was revealed to us. What was revealed to Abraham, Ishmael, Isaac, Jacob, and the tribes, to Moses, and Jesus, and the other prophets by their Lord. We make no distinction amongst any of them, and to Allah we have surrendered ourselves. So here he is saying, I accept Jewish faith, or the faith of Abraham, but I'm not prepared to accept the Jewish religion. I'm not accepting Jewish revelations. I think that you got it distorted. He begins to differentiate, and he's again making more of a pan monotheism that's going to put in the same breath Moses, literally side by side here, Moses and Jesus. So you can see down in Ayah 30, 139 and 140, do you claim that Abraham, Ishmael, Isaac, Jacob, and the tribes were all Jews or Christians? Question mark. Do you know better than Allah himself? Who is more wicked than the man who hides a testimony which he has received from Allah? So again, he is saying here, you have received your own revelation. It isn't a question of becoming just a Jew or becoming just a Christian. There's now a third alternative. You can become a Muslim. That's what submit here means. We are the ones who have submitted. We are the Muslims, the submitted ones. So he is beginning to distinguish himself as a separate movement in this passage. And while we're in the neighborhood, look at Surah 2, 142. Now we're talking about change in the Quran. Here's one of the changes. And this may get a little ahead of ourselves, but you probably already know that when Muslims pray, what direction do they face? They face not only toward east, they face toward Mecca specifically. Wherever they are, they orient toward Mecca. All right. Now, that is significant because that direction of prayer, which we'll look at later in the course, is called the Qibla. And you'll notice in Surah 2, 142, the foolish will ask, what has made them change their Qibla? Do you see that in the text? Okay, what he is referring to there is the fact that the Muslims, when they first began to orient their prayer, guess what they prayed toward? Jerusalem. They're facing, that's what the Jews did, right? You know, Daniel faced Jerusalem when he prayed. All of the revelation or the prayers were toward Jerusalem in the Jewish community. So Muhammad did the same thing. He copied Jewish practice. So when he changes from facing Jerusalem, which was essentially west of them, as opposed to facing Mecca, which is largely east of them, then you have a distinct change in the direction of prayer. So all of this, he made the change actually officially happens in 2, 144. We will make you turn towards a Qibla that will please you. Turn towards the holy mosque. So here for the first time you find Muhammad directing his followers to turn toward the Kaaba rather than toward Jerusalem. So big changes are occurring in the way he relates to the other movements. Now two big battles occur in the year 624 and 625. I'm maintaining our own recount of the years. This is obviously the second year and the third year Hejra, A-H, after Hejra. But the first is the Battle of Badr, and the second is the Battle of Uhud. These two battles are extremely important because not only historically these battles are important, but they have become how do I say it? They've become metaphorical in Muslim discussions. Even Saddam Hussein make reference to the Battle of Badr. These are very important battles. They take on great significance theologically. So we need to look briefly what these two battles mean. Muhammad has himself now embedded into Medina. He wants to return to Mecca. This, of course, is the goal of the movement, is to return to Mecca and control the heart of the Muslim empire. The Arab empire is all in Mecca. Mecca is the main city. This is where the Kaaba is. Everything is oriented toward Mecca. So he has to consolidate in order to control Mecca. The problem is the Meccans realize this. They are extremely threatened by the power base growing in Medina. So they engage in battles. They come up to Medina to engage Muhammad in battle and to hopefully defeat him on his own grounds. So there are two very famous battles. The first one is a battle called the Battle of Badr in 624, where Muhammad is met in battle by a tremendous force led by, amazingly, Quraishian Meccans. These are his own tribal people coming to oppose Muhammad on the field of battle, led by a guy named Abu Jahal. The Meccans, again, these are traditional numbers. Actually, the Quran says they're twice the number, but traditionally, Muslims say that Muhammad had 319 followers, which is often interpreted in all kinds of symbolic ways, but 319 followers, and he had facing 1,000 of the finest crack troops of the Quraysh tribe. So this is basically 3-to-1 almost face down. So it's very important theologically because here you have this superior army that is facing Muhammad. Muhammad is outgunned, outmanned, everything, and yet the Muslims rout the 1,000 Meccans and they defeat them. Now this has become the great symbol of the mother of all battles. This is referred to as the mother of all battles. Now when Saddam Hussein, some years ago now, but when he made his famous claim that this will be the mother of all battles, in his own discussion with his people on television, even though he himself wasn't a practicing Muslim, he suddenly became a practicing Muslim. You know, he starts doing performing salat and all this stuff, you know, but he became a devout Muslim in order to tie in. And you cannot fault the fact that he understood the importance of Islamic history. And so he said, fighting the West and overthrowing, the Western powers will be our, this battle of Badr. That's what this is. It'll be the mother of all battles. It's a clear historical reference point for Muslims that we can defeat against innumerable odds. And the amazing thing is after the whole thing was over with, from our point of view, he was defeated, right? But that wasn't his point of view at all. Because if you look at his, he had several major enemies. He had George Bush, Sr. He had Margaret Thatcher. He had Francois Mitterrand. Francois Mitterrand and Mikhail Gorbachev. His four major challengers. All four of them are now out of power. Guess where he is? He's still in power. And so, he says, we won. We won. All my opponents, Allah has deposed all my opponents. And it happened quickly. I mean, Mitterrand got cancer, died, Bush was kicked out of office by, Clinton. You had the Margaret Thatcher was very quickly went out of power, and John Major came through, and now we have Tony Blair. So he looks and says, "Hey, I'm the only one still standing." I mean, to him, he won. I mean, this is them thinking of the Battle of Badr. So this is the kind of thing that this battle plays. The second battle. Battle of Uhud is in 625, 1 year later. This happens near Medina. It's a repeat of the earlier battle in that it's between the Meccan Quraysh and, again, the newly emerging Muslims. This time, though, they're led by a different leadership, a guy named Abu Sufyan, and there are now 3,000 Meccans that come onto the battlefield. And in this battle, just the opposite result. The Muslims are divided. They have a very humiliating defeat. Muhammad himself is badly wounded. And this becomes the symbol of a great, horrible defeat by the Muslims. Now, I shouldn't say it in negative terms, because at this day, this battle of Uhud is used, and even the Quran, it's used to symbolize the role of martyrdom. This becomes the seed bed for the whole theology of martyrdom in Islamic thought, that there are times when Allah asks you to lay down your life for the greater cause. And so what he's saying is that Muhammad realized that blood must be spilt in this cause to be successful. Muhammad himself spilt blood on this battlefield. He himself was wounded, etc. And therefore, this becomes kind of the archetype of martyrdom. If you look at Surah 3, I'll make a reference to this only because some of you may be reading that fairly soon, if not already. In this particular surah, you have, by the way, this is named Imram. You know who Imram is? Father of someone in the Old Testament. Right, that's right. This Imram is the father of Moses. And this is referenced in this chapter, so it becomes the title of the chapter, the Imrans. Now, this surah gives account of both of the battles. And so you might want to make note of that when you're reading, to keep that in mind. He says about the Battle of Badr, for example, in Surah 3:13, there was a sign for you in the two armies which were on the battlefield. One was fighting for the cause of Allah, the other a host of unbelievers. The faithful saw with their very eyes, they were twice their own number. But Allah strengthens those who and aids those whom He will. Surely in that there's a lesson. You have in Surah 3, Ayah 102, supposedly the address that Muhammad gave his followers before the Battle of Uhud. He addresses them in, I think it's 105, where he says, 102, believers, fear Allah as you rightly should, and when death comes, die true Muslims. And so, you know, again, this is the martyrdom theme that comes out in the revelation that interprets this event. In Surah 3, 121, you actually begin to see there is some division in the Islamic community. Remember when you, that is Muhammad, left your people at an early hour to lead the faithful to the battle post? Allah heard all and knew all. Two of your battalions became faint-hearted, but Allah was their protector. Again, he is discussing the possibility of division in the Muslim camp. So there are several passages along the way that refer to these battles. So with these two battles behind him, Muhammad returns to Medina for 5 years. And for 5 years, he consolidates his power. Again, we're covering a lot of history here quickly, but I'm trying to get this basic historical part over with. I'm more interested in the theological development. They dig a huge trench around the whole city of Medina, which, of course, is considerably smaller in those days than it is today. And they have several other battles, one of which is called the Battle of the Trenches or Battle of the Ditch in the year 5 AH, 627. And they are, again, fighting Quraysh tribes. But essentially, because of this ditch, they had made Medina essentially a fortress that could not be attacked. So this gave them time to consolidate and to grow as a movement. And meanwhile, he's, again, making treaties with certain tribes. They're bringing more people into the movement. And finally, in the year 630, and if you notice on the back of your sheet, this is another key date that we want to have in your mind, locked in your mind. 630 A.D., this is the 8th A.H., this is when Muhammad finally decides he's strong enough to take Mecca. Now, you realize now, for all of these years, he has had tremendous conflict with not only the Meccans in general, but particularly the Quraysh tribe. They have fought him and fought him and fought him. A lot of blood has been shed. There's difficulties happening. Muhammad has, by the way, this triangle has broken down during this period. He believes the Jews, because of all their bickering, have broken this treaty that he had with the Jews toward peace. So there is, it's a very sad chapter, actually, in the history of the world, but there are several battles where Muhammad slaughters many Jews. And it's a very tragic thing where you have a number of Medinan Jews that lose their life. So Muhammad now has severed himself from the Jewish movement, and this Arab movement has really grown significantly. So he comes back. There are no Jews marching in this army now. We're talking about a purely Arab movement now. It's large enough so that Muhammad believes he can maybe, with the luck of the Battle of Badr, be able to actually win Mecca. This is a bold move on his part because, again, his numbers do not warrant this kind of attack on Mecca. You know, he's been defending Medina all this time, and they've been the attackers. Now he is going on an offensive move to actually attack the city of Mecca. He had, just to make sure that I'm not exposing myself to potential misunderstanding, he had actually been to Mecca on two occasions, in 628 and also in 630 before this event. He had been given safe passage into Mecca. Again, these treaties were widely honored, and if he made an agreement to come in under peace, he could do that. So he actually had some discussions with Meccans that were in favor of his cause. So they regard it as miraculous, but you should be aware that he had some contact with Mecca prior to his return. But in the Muslim telling of the story, he comes into Mecca preparing for a huge, massive, bloody battle, the mother of all battles, once again repeated. But instead, the city completely surrenders without resistance. There is no opposition to Muhammad in the year 630 AD when he comes back into the city. Muhammad takes this as a great sign from Allah. He grants immunity to all his former enemies, and Muhammad takes the city. He immediately goes to the Kaaba, which of course is the heart of the city. This is the very place his own tribe had protected. He enters the Kaaba and he cleanses the temple. That's the only way to put it. He goes through, he takes out every idol one by one. He destroys the idol publicly. He burns it. He destroys it. He runs out all of the people that are involved in the idolatrous trade. He encircles the Kaaba seven times, which had become significant for later Muslim practice. Muslims this day still encircle it seven times and go to Mecca. And he paid homage to one particular object in the Kaaba, which of course is what? The black stone is given homage because he knew from his early days growing up in Mecca that that stone was the stone the Hanifs said was the stone that represented Arab monotheism. It was the one link they believed that the Arabs had, one physical link between Abraham and the Muslim or the Arab peoples was this stone. And therefore, Muhammad did not destroy that stone, and he destroyed all the others. And so this event becomes important spiritually because it is the official renunciation of idolatry by the Arabs, at least the followers of Islam. And culturally, this is the end of all this divided tribalism, which, the idol worship, it symbolized that, because every tribe had their own god. And now you have a much more united Arab movement beginning to happen. Now, to be fair, even at Muhammad's death, the Arab tribes were not united behind Muhammad. And it was some time before all the Arabs really came on board. But certainly the western part of the country is beginning to be united. And that's significant. In fact, in the Quran itself, if you look at Surah 9, Ayah 18, it actually describes this, where he cleanses the... this actually is applied to all of the mosques. Let me read this for you. In 9:18, he says, "None should visit the mosques of Allah except those who believe in Allah and the last day. Now, the word mosque here, just all that means, it does not mean building. It means place of prostration. So he's saying here, the places of prostration to Allah are sacred. Only those who are Muslims, in other words, should visit the mosques. Now, that's why to this day, if you're in sensitive areas where Islam is very strong, they will not permit Christians to enter into the mosque. Obviously, certain ones, especially the grand open air mosque of in Mecca, which is what this refers to mainly here. You cannot visit that as an outsider. Only through secret intrigue have outsiders gone into that. There are other sacred holy mosques throughout the Muslim world where outsiders cannot come, based on this text here. So what he does is he declares what's called a haram. He declares a haram is a purification of the city of Mecca, where all the idolaters are expelled, and this becomes a sacred city, basically, where only Muslims can set foot in the city. So it's very unlikely that we'll be able to establish a mission outpost in Mecca. You know, this is not a possibility because outsiders are simply not allowed. This, by the way, is important as well because other cities in the Muslim, as the Muslim world grows, they do the same thing. The most famous one in Western literature is the city Timbuktu. Most of you grew up, hearing stories and in the poetry and about Timbuktu. Well, Timbuktu is a city in West Africa, in Mali, modern-day Mali, which it was founded as a Muslim city. It was patterned after Mecca. The idea was no non-Muslim will ever set foot in this city. This is a sacred city. No non-Muslims allowed. And the idea was that this city would have people falling down their faces day and night, five times a day for all eternity, and there's no idolatry or problems or whatever else. So Westerners couldn't go to Timbuktu. And so you had this marvelous situation, even though their peak was Timbuktu, 1400 to 1600, when the missionaries began to arrive in Africa, they couldn't go to Timbuktu. And so you had a few examples where missionaries would bring stories back about this obscure place, Timbuktu, where nobody could go. Nobody was allowed. You had one very famous sketch someone made from an overlooking hill, a sketch of the city of Timbuktu, because nobody from the West could go there. And it created kind of an allure in the West about Timbuktu. That's the way Mecca is to this day. Outsiders aren't allowed. And there's an allure to the whole place because of that. And it actually goes back to the Quran. Muhammad said, okay, we have the authority to set aside certain cities as sacred mosques where outsiders cannot enter. So Mecca becomes now an Islamic stronghold. And to this day, that mosque is the most important mosque in Islam. It's called the Grand Mosque. This is a translation of it. I think we'll stick with the translations rather than... the Grand Open Air Mosque is the number one mosque in the world. The second is known as the Prophet's Mosque. This is one that occurs in Medina. And this is the first place where Muhammad went and in the city of refuge, and so therefore it's become very, very important. There's another one called the Prophet's Prayer Mosque. This is the third most important one in the world. This is all these are in Saudi Arabia. This is the first place where Muhammad performed the prayer facing the Kaaba, the famous prayer toward the Kaaba, and this also is believed to be the first place he prayed after the Hijra when he fled out of Mecca. The fourth one, and the reason I gave you this list is so you'll know where all this comes to. The fourth one is the Dome of the Rock. Again, they don't call it that, but this is the what you'd recognize it as. The Dome of the Rock is the fourth most important mosque in the world. Now, all three of these mosques are in modern-day Saudi Arabia, so therefore, the Dome of the Rock is the most important mosque outside of Saudi Arabia. It's important, we're a little ahead of ourselves to say why it's important, but I'll go ahead and mention it. Dome of the Rock is important because one of the things that happens to Muhammad when he's meditating on the and receiving the Quran is that at one point he receives what is called night journeys. By the way, you notice a chapter in the Quran called the night journey. This is where Muhammad goes to sleep in Mecca, but during the night he is transported on a white stallion all the way, on a winged white stallion, all the way to Jerusalem. And he, at Jerusalem, Muhammad ascends to heaven where he receives revelations in the presence of Allah. Again, mediated through Gabriel, but nevertheless, he actually is brought up into the very, like, seven heavens, and it is all what happens at various stages. And by the way, that's where he received the fivefold prayer. And this is all recorded, not in the Quran, but in the Hadith. But they believe that occurred on that spot, is where he ascended and descended. And therefore, it's extremely sacred to the Muslims. And this, of course, is the same place where Jews believe is the location of the temple, and even earlier, the location, many believe, of Mount Moriah, where Abraham sacrificed Isaac. And so all of this becomes extremely volatile, and you can appreciate even now a little bit of why this area is so volatile in the current conflict. Those are some brief historical points along the way. I think that will give you a little bit of a general guideline. I don't intend to really say a lot more about the historical development until we have the death of Muhammad. Once Muhammad dies, we need to once again revisit the history and talk about some of the developments after his death. But at this point, we're going to go back, and now that we more or less have the Quran in hand, as it were, we want to be able to say, okay, what does the Quran teach, and what ways is it similar to or distinct from the Jewish revelation?
Thank you for listening to this lecture brought to you by biblicaltraining.org. Feel free to make copies of this lecture to give to others, but please do not charge for these copies or alter the content in any way without permission. We invite you to visit our website at www.biblicaltraining.org. There you will find the finest in evangelical teaching for use in the home and the church, and it is absolutely free. Our curriculum includes classes for new believers, lay education classes, and seminary-level classes taught by some of the finest seminary teachers drawn from a wide range of evangelical traditions. Our mailing address is Post Office Box 28428, Spokane, Washington, 99228, USA.